This is Paraset Seminar, Bible Study 915P for Thursday, March 5th, 2009. Subject today, and I'm going to hustle through this fairly quickly, but the subject for today is some stupid ideas about parasitism, and I should probably warn you that when we started signing up for Paraset seminar topics earlier in the semester, and the sheet went around, and there was some discussion about doing something really strange and different and creative this semester, and I thought, well, the best thing that I can think of is to talk about some really stupid ideas. And so it turns out that these are really stupid ideas that I've been thinking were stupid for a long, long, long time. So I'm just sort of putting them together. And for those of you who are taking notes, I have meetings much of the afternoon, but this evening I'll put both the PDF of this and the voice stuff up on my website. You can just go to my website and click lectures and presentations and you'll find this kind of stuff. So there really are, as far as I am personally convinced, there are three really stupid ideas about the most common way of life on Earth. And the first one is that there is indeed an evolutionary arms race between hosts and parasites. And this we have heard over and over and over again from various places and in various contexts. Second one is that you can actually study the effects of parasitism on any species of common animal out in the wild, out where it lives in nature. And I've picked the pictures on these first two slides for very specific reasons. And the third one, which really stupid idea, is that the fundamental Darwinian principles can in fact explain some of the taxonomic diversity, some of the structural diversity that we use and have used, at least in alpha taxonomy, particularly of platyhelminthes, trematodes, and cestodes. And that much of that alpha taxonomy, at least the first few the couplets in many of the keys, concern the nature of the reproductive organs and where they are, the reproductive anatomy, number of testes, location, that sort of thing. So I'm going to talk about these things more or less in sequence. I've picked this picture of this Paramiscus maniculatus to talk about the evolutionary arms race for a very specific reason, and that is, at one point or another, I had a reason to develop the picture of a host as a community. And in doing so, the first thing I did was just turn around and pull a copy of the host parasite, particularly the host volume for one of the paper versions of the index catalog. And it just so happened that was an issue that had been in which the information covered the period from 1973 to 1976. So there's nothing special about that particular time period. It just happened to be the first book I pulled off the shelf. And I looked up Paramiscus maniculatus and then just started typing in all of the various parasites that had been reported in that particular issue. And it turns out that a bunch of these are fleas, and some of them are mites, and some of them are ticks, and at least one of them is a dipteran. The important point to remember in the next minute or two, of course, is that these are all arthropods. These are only the arthropods. And if you were looking at Paramiscus maniculatus over a period of time and space, you would find a whole lot of stuff in addition to these arthropods. And in any one collection, you might not find all of these. In fact, you might not find very many of them. But this is what when we're talking about Paramiscus maniculatus, this is what we mean, sort of, because it's a very incomplete story, but it's complete enough to talk about. So I counted about 34 of those. And I've modeled this interaction between the hosts and the parasites sort of in the following way. Each of those circles, or ovals, I suppose they are, represent different groups of these parasites, and the internal textures and colors represent different kinds of biologies, and the arrows, of course, of different formats indicate maybe different kinds of interactions. So the fleas, for example, will have quite a different interaction with this host than will some of the trombiculid mites. And so we're really looking at, and I think that there are 34 of those. This is nothing more than just kind of a graphic way of presenting what every parasitologist knows about that previous slide, especially if you know the scientific names that are involved. So we're still talking about this in context of the so-called evolutionary arms race. Now, we'll go back to some really, really common, simple, and well-known ideas about macro parasites, and incidentally, all of those arthropods on that list should probably be considered macro parasites. And this is the idea of a population distribution on the host. And so, and this is a slide that I just sort of concocted in order for really for the BioSci 385 class, for the express purpose of just simply demonstrating what we mean when we talk about a population distribution. So here are some parasite per host classes. Number of hosts, we see it over in area one. Most of these hosts are really uninfected or have either one or two parasites. And out here in blue, you have a couple of fairly heavily infected hosts. And over in area two, then you have a very different kind of a distribution where you have a much lower prevalence of parasites in the sense that your relative number of uninfected hosts is quite a bit lower, and you have quite a few, as indicated by the height of those bars, quite a few host individuals who have quite a few more parasites than. So this kind of an observation of a single parasite species, a macroparasite species, in a single host species in two different geographical areas with different sets of encounter conditions is typical. I mean, this is exactly what you would expect and anticipate if you went out and did the study on hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of parasites. However, unless there's some real genetic reason for these distributions, it really is kind of doubtful that an arms race can occur. Though, and to my knowledge, and I won't claim to have done an absolutely, totally exhaustive search for these numbers or these papers, but to my knowledge, there never has been a clear genetic explanation for distributions such as these, as opposed to distributions that you would interpret as being of ecological origin, as opposed to a genetic origin. And unless you have this distribution, which incidentally, down on all of these bars that start one and higher, these are cases where the parasite genetic diversity is displayed against that of the host. And these bars over the zero class are where they are not. So in certain cases, most of the parasite data or parasite genetic variation is displayed against most of the host variation, and other cases vice versa. So this particular one is really a summary of a kind of a continuation of this discussion of parasite distributions and the behavior of population distribution parameters over time and space. So what I've done here is simply indicated some relative probabilities of infection. So in one case, you have here, the blue line is not really varying very much, so there's not a whole lot of heterogeneity in the probability of infection. But in the case of the red line, a different time, a different place, a different system, there is a great deal of it over time. And in many of the, much of the work that we've done, both with hosts in nature and also some of the modeling, really shows that if you take a series of samples over time and space, and these samples are relatively homogeneous within themselves. So a good example might be 25 or 30 fish of a single species from a single day's collection in a single site in the South Platte River, and then another homogeneous, relatively homogeneous sample might be 25 or 30 taken 100 miles downstream, 100 miles upstream, or 60 days later, or something of the sort. So the structure of the data sets here are what really reveal some underlying processes. So when this probability of infection varies significantly and greatly over time and space, then you end up with really a lot of heterogeneity in the host-parasite interactions. And the net result of that is that mean intensity tends to be disconnected from both prevalence and mean abundance. And these, and if you summarize this whole data set right here, you'd find that it was highly aggregated. But if those probabilities of infections over time and space tend to be relatively stable, then you end up with a situation where prevalence and mean abundance and mean intensity, and particularly prevalence and mean intensity, are track one another pretty well. And so the reason for that is, if you go back to the definitions of those terms, you realize that mean abundance is your average number of parasites per host in a sample, and mean intensity is your average number of parasites per infected host. So out of 100 hosts, you could either have each host with one and you'd have a mean abundance of one, or you could have all 100 parasites in one host and you have the same. So, but those two things are mean something very, very different in terms of the display of parasite genetic information against that of the host. So the questions that really come up immediately when we consider this business of the evolutionary arms race are, which parasites are we talking about? Do any of them act in concert? You have regularly five or six different species of parasites in a single host species in a single place. Do they act independently of one another, et cetera, et cetera? And if any of them act in concert, which ones are they? What is it exactly that's evolving? Is it some component of a cellular immune response? Is it a single cytokine? Is it blah blah blah? Is it epithelial thickness? What is it? And then, can you in fact measure the relative impact of these parasites on fitness? And if so, is that enough? Or I should say, maybe is it of a kind that allows you to conclude that it drives genetic change in the host? So can these things evolve? So let's talk about the mouse a little bit and really address this last question. Can you measure the relative impact of parasites on fitness? And if so, is that impact enough to drive evolution? And this is something I've been thinking about for a long, long, long time. And I think it comes from just being old and having children that you've paid in automobile insurance on for a long time, and having property that you pay insurance on. And of course, insurance rates are risks. They're based on risk. So you might ask yourself, if you're a field biologist and know anything at all about Paramyscus maniculatus, what are the big risks to fitness? And I've sort of tried to illustrate this idea by making the font size large, sort of representative of the source of this risk. And I would say between owls, bull snakes, and coyotes, at least in the area that I'm familiar with, these are your real biggies. So you would expect that these things would be your driving force on mouse evolution. And the only reason rattlesnakes are a little bit in smaller types, because I don't think there are so many of them as there are coyotes and bull snakes. And then there, of course, there are the issues of annual fluctuations in weather and consequently in seed supply, competition with other mice, and then way down at the bottom, I think, is the issue of all the parasites combined. So my sense is, and this is just simply intuitive, and I'm not sure anybody's really gone out and done a risk assessment of fitness relative to mice. But if you're a field biologist and ask, and particularly if you're a field parasitologist and ask yourself, what's the real danger to these things? What's going to have an impact on the reproductive success of mice? And these top ones really seem to far override everything else. And I think you could probably model all of that if you wanted to spend the time and could get the data. So all this interaction is taking place out in nature, of course, instead of in the lab. And I won't necessarily go through the symbolism of this, but because it's going to become obvious by the end. So my general response is, you got to be kidding. When you think about the evolutionary arms race, it's one of those good ideas that really, in my mind, turns out to be a pretty stupid idea. However, it has legs because there are a few cases, particularly involving microorganisms, that seem to be behave in ways consistent with this idea, even in human beings. Now, stupid idea number two, that is that you can actually study the effects of parasitism on a single species of really common animal, wild animal. And I picked this bluegill here just because I like the picture as much as anything else. And we've done a lot of work on bluegill parasites in places like Dunwoody Pond. And again, for this same talk, a number of years ago, I was looking for a list of parasites of a particular host, and I went straight to Lepomis macrochirus. I think I got it out of the next host index catalog book that was there. Again, just turned around, pulled one off the shelf. And here they are. And so a lot of these are monogenous in the sense that they only have one host, such as the monogenes that are on there. But there are some others that are larval stages of parasites that occur in gray blue herons, for example, Coprocecum being a good one. There are some of those that have intermediate hosts, such as Spinetectus and Bothriocephalus and Protocephalus and Neocynorrhynchus. So there's a whole variety of these things. And so the diversity of host-parasite interactions, and the diversity of factors that really control the movement of parasites in and out of this system is quite a bit more complex than it is for the mice. And so, but nevertheless, we have exactly the same question with this bluegill that we did with Paramyscus maniculatus before. But the one of the really prime differences, and this is actually the figure out of the new edition of Foundations, this is the color version of it, that was drawn by Bill Obert. But in addition to all of those interactions between the fish and the parasite, you have all of these organisms that are involved, the definitive host, the first intermediate host for some of these, second intermediate hosts, the ecological conditions under which Sicaria may survive. I'm sorry, over here. So the whole system really is much more complicated than the one that we just talked about in the case of mice. But the only reason the one in mice didn't appear so complicated is because we included only the arthropods. So the central questions involving parasites in wild animals: how do I test the experiments to actually test how do I design the experiments to actually test some hypothesis about the effects of parasitism? To what extent would the principles established by such a study could be generalized or transported or transferable? And finally, what do these answers tell us about the fundamental nature of our science in general? And I'll get to that toward the end. So here's our minimal list of stuff to do if you're actually going to approach this problem. And I don't know that this list of stuff is really the correct list or the definitive list or the exhaustive list. It's just simply the list that came immediately to my mind about how to design the experiments to test the hypothesis. Now, how do you do the research? Well, first of all, you have to find or create a bunch of sort of semi-replicate populations of bluegills in semi-similar regional setting. And I'm using the word semi in kind of a smart-ass way. But you have to have a number of replicate settings that are pretty close to one another in a variety of ways. You need to determine kind of your baseline health of those, and I don't know how you do that. You could do it, I suppose, with growth weight, growth/weight measurements. You could do it with some kind of blood chemistry. I put in here the cliff swallow model mainly because Charles Brown actually kind of did this. But when you go back and look at what he did it with respect to cliff swallows, and he did it with by looking at only one parasite, and that was the swallow bugs, Ociacus vicarius. And this was real simple in the sense that he just simply took some tanglefoot, some sticky stuff, and painted down the middle of a very large cliff swallow colony under a culvert. And then he took some just insecticide and cleaned out half of that colony. And the bugs, of course, because they're flightless, simply couldn't get across the barrier. So he ended up then, and he did this really early on, and he ended up then with a large colony, half of which had a bunch of blood-sucking parasites in it, and half of them which did not. And he discovered on that basis that the fledging weight for those with the bed bugs was about half that of the unparasitized cliff swallows. And of course, fledging success then is really a kind of a function of fledging weight. So this is the only one that I know of. This is the study that's actually been done, and in this regard, successfully at least. And if you look at the system, you realize that all you have to do to get your statistically valid test is go underneath a culvert and paint some tanglefoot down the wall and get a bug bomb and spray the nests on one half. And that's the system allows you to do that. So then you're going to have to separate your replicate populations into statistically relevant groups. So remember that in this case, in the case of the questions that we're asking about parasite effects on wild animals, a population is the equivalent of one nest of a cliff swallow. It's sort of the statistical or the sampling equivalent. So you've got to separate these populations into relevant groups. You have to remove these parasites one by one. I suppose you could remove them all and then reintroduce them one by one. But this task, I almost assure you, is borderline logistically impossible. So either way you do it is pretty much impossible. And that's not all, however. Well, wait a minute. What did I do? Oops. Sorry, the numbering is off. This should have been 5, 6, and 7. So then you start removing these parasite species in all possible combinations. And if you only have 5 as opposed to the 30, then you have to do 30 such studies, because that's removing them one at a time, removing them 4 at a time, removing them 2 at a time, and all the various combinations. So you have 10 different combinations of 5 things taken to. Is that right? Did I do that? Maybe I didn't do that right. Was it 5 factorial over 3 factorial times 2 factorial? Is that correct? Dave, I think that's close. Yeah. So at any rate, you'd have to do all of this research about 30 separate times with if you only had five parasite species. And during all of this time, you'd have to ensure that all the external factors are kept constant, and that includes heron visits and relative weather and such things as rain, washing nutrients in off of the surrounding ground so that your protozoan populations grow, and therefore all your little microcrustacean, you know, guys. So you got to hold all this stuff constantly. And then you got to find places where all those parasites are that you really didn't study so far, and repeat all this stuff. So this is why this idea is really a stupid one. You just can't do it. So can you actually study the effects of parasitism? No, not really. And you can't do it correctly. You can't do it right. You can't do it completely. Now, this is the interesting one. Fundamental Darwinian, stupid idea number three. Fundamental Darwinian principles can explain the diversity of reproductive anatomy in primitives. Well, if you're a biologist, you've got to believe that natural selection explains everything. Nothing in biology makes sense except in the context of evolution. Okay, that is sort of the mantra of biologists. And if you say that these Darwinian principles can't explain something natural, then you're sort of stepping into the creationist realm.
About those people lately have been pushing some of those old Lamarckian ideas. Have you seen any of these books that have come out in the last 3 or 4 years?
No, I haven't followed the Lamarckians.
Those are mostly the microbe thing, so it doesn't apply to...
Yeah, I mean, they're talking about epigenetics and change in a lifetime and being inherited.
Right, mostly for microbes.
Yeah.
Actually, mostly. I think exclusively for microbes.
I think there's a few protein models, but yeah, there's nothing beyond it.
Oh, okay, so...
It's like Evolution in Four Dimensions, I think is what... I forget what her name is.
Okay.
A couple other books.
So, but we're going really back to the three fundamental Darwinian principles. And I agree, Gabe. So, actually, what we need to do is come back maybe in a later date and explore the potential for epigenetic influence on reproductive anatomy. So, why do I choose reproductive anatomy? As mentioned earlier, reproductive anatomy is, or it turns out at least, is very utilitarian, or has been considered utilitarian by human beings who work on, especially trematodes and cestodes, because we've used that anatomy over and over and over again for decades to upon which to base our alpha taxonomy. And the assumption is that if structural features are stable enough then to use as taxonomic characters, then they are evolved and they are under genetic control and they are stable. And so you take the three sort of Darwinian principles, superfecundity, heritable variation, and differential survival based on heritable variation, and address and use these three principles to address these issues right here. In other words, so here we have some tandem testes and ovary and vitellaria that extend a certain length, and here we have some side-by-side testes and vitellaria that extend to some other length. And you would find, if you get into the trematode literature, you're going to find case after case after case in which differences between species and sometimes differences between genera are based on, at least to a large extent, on some of these kind of things. If you get into the cestode literature, you're going to find exactly the same situation. So do these factors here account for these differences? That's really the question that we're asking. So I don't know if this list is exhaustive or is even particularly correct, but this list is what came to mind immediately when I tried to address that question. So what conditions are necessary for this basic classical Darwinian selection to act on testis position? Taking one of those things. Okay. More adult trematodes produced than can survive in all available hosts. We know that for sure. And this is kind of key, and infection sites. So if you're talking about lung flukes, then you're going to have to maybe demonstrate that, say, frog lung flukes, that a frog can only have a certain number. And it would seem to me that what you'd actually have to show would be that over and over and over again, a frog species in a particular habitat acquires more immature flukes than end up growing to adulthood. And I think that's probably, and you could pick anything. You could pick bladder flukes. You could pick flukes that end up in a bursa of some birds. So you can pick any place. So if you had a defined infection site within the host, it seemed to me you could, in fact, address this first question. In this particular stable, long-term stable in habitat or environment, do we have a situation in which definitive hosts get a whole lot of immature worms, and then over developmental time lose those down to some maximum number of adults? I remember Jacqueline Heltz's data on Phyllodystomum funduli and Fundulus sciaticus, and it seemed to me that this was one of those cases where that might in fact occur, simply because of the population dynamics of that worm over a number of years. Testis position must be inherited. We sort of assume that. Here we go, though. The slightest change. This is the sort of the first change rule. So the slightest change in testis position must be of some survival advantage to those worms. And all the other factors then rendered either inconsequential or not as consequential as this slightest change in testis position. So if you're going to go from tandem to paired, then the first change toward being side by side, the first departure from tandemness has to lend this survival advantage. It seems to me, this is how I interpret the Darwinian principles. So can they account for this internal structural diversity in trim toads? And I'm thinking maybe probably not. We had the same problems before, maybe not quite as severe. So the question is, where do we really, and this, now we get to the kind of the fundamental nature of our science. So where do really stupid ideas come from? And I can't remember the next slide. In my view, and again, maybe I'm just being a little sarcastic about this, but they really come from two places. One of them is honest and understandable, and that's ignorance. There's very few of us, even professional biologists, know as much as we think we do or that we could know. So I think even, and the more we know, the more we understand the extent to which we are ignorant about certain things. But even in recognizing our ignorance, I think it also comes from transfer of the human experience to the natural world. And I don't know that this is hardwired, but you're suspicious that it is. And this is one of my favorite quotes, really, that addresses this. Comes from Slobodkin's book, Simplicity and Complexity and Games of the Intellect. But I really, back in the early 80s, I kind of had gotten my comeuppance a little bit with Nelson Potter. We were working on the screenplay for the Keith County Journal film, and we had filmed a staggering amount of this stuff, and we're going through the editing and adding in and sort of modifying the script a little bit and modifying the screenplay and adding the voiceover narrative. And this script, in the meantime, as a result of this project with Nebraska Public TV, we gave this script to Nelson Potter and to Robert Noel, I believe. an English professor and philosopher and English professor, respectively. And so Nelson came back with this discussion about imposing our organization on nature. And if you go back and look at that film, which came out in 1986, then there's a line or two in there that's in the voiceover about, you know, are we imposing our order or our sense of order on nature, or the other way around. So this is Slobodkin. Natural world is not need not be logical in any obvious way. Science does not consist of imposing our reason on the world, but rather reducing our preconceptions to the point where it imposes its logic on us. This is very difficult indeed, involving minimalization of our ego, while maintaining, in other words, our full powers of observation receptivity. This is really maintaining the childhood way of looking at the world around us. So capacity to perform this feat is what we try to impart, but it's really difficult. And I think that when I see non-parasitologists talking about parasitism, it's this business of imposing the human logic on the system. Parasites have to damage. Parasites, organisms have to compete. Well, I mean, this goes on and on and on and on and on. And yet my reaction to it is, okay, in what sense? How important is it? Is it really true? How can you go about finding out? Are you imposing on me as a parasitologist the demand, in order for you to consider that I'm legitimate as a scientist, are you imposing on me the demand that I demonstrate phenomena that my realm of intellectual endeavor does not possess? So that's really kind of the thoughts that come to mind.
A great quote. Yeah.
No, it's a terrific quote. It's the one that's up on my Facebook page. It's my favorite quote. So I have about 3 minutes, maybe five at the most, to respond to any questions. I've got to get to this meeting by 1 o'clock. Anybody?
Well, it seems to me that natural selection doesn't necessarily have to operate all at once, operate over when we're looking at it. We can look at it for 50 years, we can look at a system for 100 years, we can look at it for 200 years, but when we go to the age of biology, we're looking at, let's see, when did Pangaea come apart? 160 million years ago.
Yeah.
Then when South America came apart from Africa, which was 80 million years ago. 80 million years is a long time for something to happen, so we may not necessarily get anything in our two-year observation.
Right.
It's going to make any difference at all.
Absolutely. No,
we don't know what causes something to diverge.
Well,
it happened because of something that happens only every 500 years, mm-hmm, over an 80 million year period.
And I've wondered also, Scott, whether some of these structural differences might be they might originate by mutation that's just carried on from then on, you know, that some kind of a regulatory gene mutation that suddenly gets locked into a reproductive line.
Because everybody else went extinct and the only group was left.
Yeah, or everybody else stayed in another place or something like that.
Exactly. If we put up a big phylogeny on the wall and went all the way down to the individuals and then lopped off parts and pieces, we could see that we'd be making selection for these different things, but it has nothing to do with actually fitness, bringing in a reproductive advantage. It's just a matter of random changes.
Oh, well, yeah, vicariance at a level or in an arena other than continental drift.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, I think the question, are there vicariance events that produce diversity in parasites that are of an unrecognized nature, something we haven't really studied yet?
Yeah.
Charles.
I had a question too, back to your first discussion of parasitism. You had the slide up there, John, with ranking the owl at the top of the biggest swamp. parasites down at the bottom.
Oh, the risk, there you go.
Yeah. I was looking at that, and I don't know the answer to this question, but I was wondering, I look at this, and I see one result of a strategy for owls, bull snakes, coyotes. Their influence on Paramiscus results in death. You said you take the organism, it gets eaten.
Yeah.
Might there be a larger impact that parasites have on the evolutionary arms race for these rodents because they have more strategies, even more insidious, if I can use the human nature.
Right, right.
The parasites, they have more opportunities for end results. They have more strategies, even more insidiousness. Might over the long term, those different strategies, instead of sort of putting all your eggs in one basket, might they result in a larger impact on the evolution of the rat than what you portray here?
Well, let's do a thought experiment, you know, sort of a scenario. Suppose that a particular species of flea has something in its saliva and it causes these mice to spend more time scratching than they would otherwise. So this seems kind of logical. Okay? And furthermore, that this saliva stimulates some kind of an immune reaction. So mice that scratch the most are not paying attention to the snakes around them. So let's just say that here's an indirect, here's a reasonable guess. You know, if all you had to do is play thought experiments, this is something that might, you might be able to construct that scenario. The same thing might be true of trombiculid mites, for example, anything of this sort. And then at that point, it could well be that these mice adapt by building up an immunity, acquiring the ability to build up an immunity to a certain population level that would then keep them from scratching so much that they're not aware of a snake. Something like this, you know. And you're absolutely right. That is a potential kind of indirect or long-term or subtle effect. I can also assure you that if I gave the same seminar out in certain areas, people would say, well, why aren't you studying that? Okay, folks, I've got to get to my meeting.